From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Gregory Dunn has reported fact and created fiction, and with his wife Joan Didion, he's written screenplays. On this edition of Fresh Air, John Gregory Dunn tells us how illness tricked him into writing about himself. Also, British novelist Martin Amis tells us about his new novel, London Fields. It's a story of seduction, deceit, murder, the end of the millennium, and the possible end of the world. And David Bianculli reviews two upcoming TV profiles of Monty Python's Flying Circus. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Haitian army has formally approved the appointment of the country's first woman president. This comes just hours after Military General Prosper Avril flew into exile aboard an American military plane. Alan Tomlinson is in Port-au-Prince.
Only minutes after General Avril flew out this morning en route to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, Haiti's civilian opposition leaders announced their choice as interim president. She's Supreme Court Justice Elfa Pascal Trujillo, Haiti's first female judge and now its first woman president. A few hours later, Army Chief General Erard Abraham, who has been acting as president since Avril's resignation on Saturday, met briefly at police headquarters with opposition representatives. He gave them his formal acceptance of the appointment. He pledged to work with Trujillo towards democratic elections later this year. However, the new government's first challenge would be how to deal with the army, and in particular the 1,200-man presidential guard which supported Avril to the last. Some soldiers shed tears when he was put on the plane. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
The Iran-Contra trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter continued today, and former aide Oliver North spent a second day on the witness stand. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
North began his testimony today as reluctant and recalcitrant as ever, repeatedly asserting that he didn't remember key facts that he's testified to before and arguing with the prosecutor about terminology. But in this second day of North's testimony, Judge Harold Green took an active role to bring North to heel. The witness, almost every time he's asked a question, says he doesn't remember, said the judge. It's like pulling teeth. And so time after time, question after question, the judge let prosecutor Dan Webb pound North with his previous testimony, both before Congress and at North's own trial. By day's end, North had proved to be a damaging witness against his one-time boss, John Poindexter. He testified that Poindexter knew every step of the way what he was doing in the Iran-Contra affair, that Poindexter authorized a cover-up when exposure was imminent, and that Poindexter tore up a politically embarrassing presidential finding to prevent its being disclosed to Congress and the public. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
The Bush administration indicated today that it may be willing to talk about a Democratic plan to eliminate the federal deficit, even if it includes tax increases. The plan was announced yesterday by House Ways and Means Chairman Dan Rostenkowski. It calls for a combination of tax increases, cuts, and freezes to trim the deficit from an estimated $161 billion in fiscal 1991 to a surplus of more than $30 billion by 1995. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that despite some provisions the administration couldn't support, the plan might help to advance discussion on the deficit. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones rose almost 3.5 points today to close at 2,600. This is NPR. The union representing striking Greyhound bus drivers and other workers met today with federal mediators in the first high-profile effort to end the 11-day walkout. The meeting came after sporadic violence, including a sniper attack on a moving Greyhound bus near Jacksonville, Florida, that wounded 7 passengers. Police are trying to determine whether the shooting was strike-related. Union President Jim LaSala met this morning with Federal Mediation Chief Bernard DeLury. No contract talks were scheduled, but mediators asked union leaders to discuss the dispute. It's not known whether the mediators plan to call in company officials for similar talks. In New York, a late afternoon building collapse has claimed the life of at least one person. NPR's Carol Zimmer has details.
Tons of an ornate plaster ceiling with concrete backing from the landmark Ansonia Hotel fell through the restaurant below. Emergency crews arrived at the scene and removed 16 people who had been in Croissant and Company when the accident occurred. At least three had suffered head injuries. One person died. Captain Paul Maniscalco is with Emergency Medical Services.
We removed a 30-year-old female who was crushed and killed in the collapse. At this time, fire and rescue operations are still continuing. They're into the back of the store. There's about a 500-square-foot area of collapse that consists of the concrete and the plaster ceiling.
Maniscalco says when he arrived on the scene, people were screaming, and emergency crews did not know if other restaurant patrons were trapped in the debris. Building department officials say they're still uncertain about what caused the collapse. They think it may be linked to construction or renovation on the floor above the restaurant. In New York, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
The city of Oakland, California is about to get its football team back. Oakland Mayor Lionel Wilson announced today that the Los Angeles Raiders owner Al Davis has agreed to bring the team back to its original home. The deal is worth more than $600 million. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. In 1987, writer John Gregory Dunn's doctor told him that he was a prime candidate for a heart attack. During a checkup, the doctor had found a critical lesion on a main artery. This scare set Dunn off reflecting on his life, and many of those reflections wound up in his new memoir, Harp. Harp is a derogatory term for an Irish Catholic. Dunn says he chose it because it's short, sharp, and abusive. Dunn is himself Irish Catholic, but he's a writer who's never afraid to be unpleasant. Dunn is a former staff writer for Time magazine. In 1969, he began writing fiction and realized the wealth of material available to him in his own Irish-American background. His novels include Vegas, True Confessions, Dutch Shay Jr., and The Red, White, and Blue. Since the mid-60s, he's been married to the writer Joan Didion. They've collaborated on screenplays for the films Panic in Needle Park, Play It As It Lays, the remake of A Star Is Born, and an adaptation of Dunn's novel True Confessions, which starred Robert De Niro and Robert Duvall. After the diagnosis of his heart condition, John Gregory Dunn had an angioplasty and has avoided open-heart surgery. I asked him what surprised him the most about his reaction to having a life-threatening condition.
I had never really been introspective before, and I think that if a doctor tells you that you're a candidate for a catastrophic event, it tends to focus your mind wonderfully. And you wonder who I am and how I got here. And so it was as a result of that that I began sort of thinking not about my life so much, but about the writer's life. This book was never meant to be a book. It was meant to be the introduction to a book of essays. And I was going to have an introduction of approximately 6,000 words, which is about 25 pages. And I began writing it, and it just got longer. And when I reached approximately 100 pages of manuscript, my wife said, "No, this is a book." I said, No, I can't even think of it that way. Otherwise, I'll just freeze up and not do it. And but by the time I got to be 150, 175 pages, even I knew that it was a book. But if I had thought of it as a book, the structure wouldn't have been as free form as it is in the book as it now stands. And I don't think I could have written it.
When you were having the heart problems and seeing doctors, did you try to impress your doctors that you were something special and they'd better really do a good job with you?
You do this thing. It came about accidentally. I was having an annual physical, and I had an EKG, and the doctor, I was still buckled up with all the leads were still clamped to my chest, and the doctor said, "You have a glitch." And before he even took the clamps off, he called a cardiologist and had a meeting with me and set up an appointment for me that afternoon. And so I went, and I think you try to explain to the doctor, "Listen, I'm something special. You better bring all your talent to bear on me. I mean, I don't want to check out. I've got a lot of things I have to do." I think everyone feels that way, that he is special, he or she is special.
I thought it was funny the way you really found confidence in bragging about your doctors to other people, even in talking about like the great Jim Dine prints that they had on the wall.
That's right. These doctors were specialists in this procedure called balloon angioplasty, and I had done so many that they were asked to lecture all over the world, and I thought, well, you know, these guys are really good. And on the walls, they actually had very good prints on the walls, and they had Jim Dine prints, and I heard myself saying to a nurse one day, I actually know Jim and Nancy, and she looked at me as if I were bonkers. And then you sort of see. The thought occurs to you that you might die, and you sort of see omens every place. I remember one day I was sort of I was putting Susan Sontag's telephone number in my I have a computer telephone book, and I was putting her number in it, and I lost the entire telephone book through some sort of computer error. Well, Susan had written the book Illness and Metaphor. I thought that means that I'm going to die. That is the metaphor. The next day, through some fluke, I was able to refine her telephone number. And so I said, now I'm going to live. But you have the sense of this is the last time I will go to Dodger Stadium. This is the last time I will go to this restaurant. This is the last time I'll buy a suit. Should I even buy a suit? I wouldn't even answer letters because I was afraid that if I did die, it would be too creepy for someone to receive a letter that that I had sent before I did die.
When you were experiencing all this, would you go through a reaction and then measure your response and say, is this response worthy of something I'd write in fiction, or is this a cliched response unworthy of the person who I am?
What I always knew was that this was really good material. And a writer is always sort of trolling for material. And so the first thing I did was open up a file, which was called CAD, coronary artery disease, also CAD, which I thought sometimes people think I am. So it was, I knew that everything, including the Jim Dine prints and the doctor's walls and the sort of nurse ratchet when I checked into the hospital, that all this stuff was really good material. I think all writers are so detached that they see everything as a possible source of material.
My guest is John Gregory Dunn, and his new book is a series of autobiographical pieces. It's called Harp. You write about your encounter with possible death through heart problems. You write about the actual deaths of people in your family, the suicide of your brother, and the murder of your niece, Dominique Dunn, who's the daughter of your brother, the writer Dominic Dunn. And you explain you didn't go to the murder trial, and you even tried to convince your brother Dominic not to go, and that you'd like to think that if it had been your daughter who was murdered, that you wouldn't have gone to the trial. Why were you so opposed to attending the murder trial?
Well, I've been to so many murder trials, and essentially, I'd been to so many murder trials which I'd covered as a reporter or just gone out of writer's interest. And I knew that in any murder trial, the victim is always put on trial. And shortly before the trial began. I had dinner one night with an old friend of mine, David Halberstam, and David's brother had been murdered the year before. And he said to me, are you going to go to the trial? And I said, my instinct is not to. And he said, don't. He said, the person they're going to talk about up there bears no relation to person who you know. And in most murder trials, the victim is made a co-conspirator in her own murder. And it was just awful thinking of that. Then there was an additional thing, which I did not put in the book. My wife and I were both on the witness list, as was my daughter. And we had reason to suspect, good reason, that we would be called as hostile witnesses by the defense. And we wanted no part of that, and so we left.
Your brother Dominic not only attended the trial, but reported on it for Vanity Fair. What was your reaction to his reporting on it?
It was intensely moving. My feeling about that is I don't wish to impose my view on anyone else. I just don't want to I don't want to be a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it cathartic.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you, since you've written about the death of people in your family and your own fear of death when you found out about, you know, the heart problems you were having, I was wondering if you now think of yourself as being more obsessively absorbed when that kind of period comes over you about your own death or about the possible death of people close to you? Do you know what I mean? I think everybody goes through these periods of, like, really getting involved with thinking about death.
I think one of the oddest things about this whole experience is that I used to be terrified of my own death.
Uh-huh.
I am less so now. I am terrified about the death of loved ones, but not really about my own.
Why are you less worried about your own death now?
I think because once you brush mortality or have a brush with mortality, that you it's not that you don't it's not that it's n- that it's not bad, but it's no longer unknown, and I think it's the unknown that is terrifying.
Do you ever get very irrational in your fears of the death of others?
Not irrational. I just sometimes. I mean, if I hear the telephone ring at 3 o'clock in the morning, I hate to pick it up because there's nothing good that can come from a telephone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's either going to be a drunk or a hang up or a wrong number or something like that, or it's going to be bad news. That's how I got the news of my brother's suicide, and that's how I got the news of my niece's murder. And so if I hear the telephone ring at 4 o'clock in the morning now, I just cannot make myself pick up the phone.
But you will pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is writer John Gregory Dunn. He's written journalism, novels, screenplays. His new book, Harp, is a memoir, and it's just been published. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer John Gregory Dunn is my guest. In your new book, Harp, you write that your motto is get mad and get even. And you say, although it is not necessary for a writer to be an expletive, neither does it hurt, resentment sharpens his eye, hostility hones his killer instinct. Is this a persona or is this a philosophy for you about writing?
I think essentially it is a philosophy. I think most writers are outsiders. Writing itself is an astonishingly hostile and aggressive act. I mean, you can cover up the writing with subordinate clauses and make it flowery, et cetera, and so forth. But what you are saying to the reader is, this is how I view things. I want you to view things my way. And no matter how nice you make the writing, you are still imposing yourself and your view of things on the reader. So it starts off being a very hostile and aggressive act. Then I think that writers are essentially outsiders, that they find their material where it, everything they see is a source of material, and their nose is always pressed up against the window on the other side of which usually is their material. And I think it is that being an outsider that makes it hostile. Makes you hostile.
You talk about writing being a hostile and aggressive act, and I'm reminded of the fact that you say when you go to someone's house, you always examine their medicine chest and see what kind of pills they're taking so you can find out what's up with them.
Well, I think that you can find... I mean, this is when I do visit... Now, obviously, I have blown my cover, so I can't do it.
Invitations, right?
And so, but you can find entire social and sexual and personal histories in someone's needless to say, medical histories in someone's medicine chest. And I always used to look in the medicine chest, and it's amazing that since I wrote that, the number of people who have come up to me and whispered that they do too.
Well, how much of a license to be a snoop does writing give you, do you think?
I think it gives you total license, but I think that if you get caught, you have to pay the penalty.
My guest is writer John Gregory Dunn. He has a new book. It's a series of autobiographical pieces called Harp. One of the things that you did after you got over your heart problems was to go to Ireland, and you're of Irish Catholic descent, mm-hmm. and describe your family as having gone from steerage to suburbia in three generations. Mm-hmm. But that, on the other hand, you never really related much to being Irish Catholic till you were in your 40s.
That's not quite true. I never related to being Irish. Irish from Ireland. My Irishness was a component of parochial school and of priests and nuns, but not of the place called Ireland. And I never really had any interest in going to the place called Ireland. And then, after this medical experience, I decided to go to Ireland to see if I could track down my grandfather's birth records. He had come from Ireland in the late 1860s as a young boy, and so I was sort of interested in finding out where he came from, and indeed if I had any Irish relatives in Ireland. And so I went there in a kind of quest, Holy Grail, and just ran up against a brick wall, and I found nothing in the town where he was said to have been born. There, I had checked all the baptismal records because there were no civil records kept in Ireland until in the late 1860s, and he'd been born in 1857. And so, so I checked all the baptismal records, and I ran up against a brick wall.
Did going to Ireland give you a sense of a deeper connection to the country than you'd felt before? Or did
No.
you still feel disconnected from it?
Yes. Enduring feeling I had from it was how beautiful it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was there in early June. There was no rain. It was very sunny. I went to the west coast of Ireland, and I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful place. Maybe in northern New Mexico. I mean, it was absolutely gorgeous.
But that's different from feeling
connection
to the country.
Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't want to force that feeling.
That's right.
Yeah, I've read about you that you stuttered as a child.
Still do.
Oh, well, you're certainly not right now. But I was wondering how, I was going to ask you how you got over it. Maybe you think you didn't, although, you know, you really sound quite good.
Well, you get over it because you set up a kind of distant early warning system, you know, that there are certain letters and certain words that you would stumble over. And so you prepare detours around the minefields of speech. I've always thought that I don't like to listen to a tape of myself because I notice a very odd herky-jerky cadence in the way I talk. And the reason for that is I anticipate that I'm going to stammer over something. And so find a synonym and, you know, do something to, as I said, to detour around the minefields of speech.
Mm-hmm. So you still feel a little self-conscious about speaking
Absolutely.
Publicly?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you a little bit about being a two-writer family. Your wife is the writer, Joan Didion. And I don't know if you read or edit each other's work, but I wonder if you feel that to really know each other fully, that you have to read everything that the other person wrote.
I don't know if you have to know someone if you have to read what he or she wrote. We just do, and we always have. Joan and I were friends for 6 or 7 or 8 years before we began keeping company. And so this is a long-standing process with us. The only thing we do together is a motion picture screenplay. But when we are working on a prose piece, we do show each other the things that we are working on. And because we are so close to each other, we give each other very much more acute advice, I think, than a normal editor would give, because we know how the other thinks, and we think we know where the work is going. And so we can say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And I am forever grateful for the advice that she has given me, and I think that she would say the same about me.
I don't know how you are in accepting criticism or how she is, but it's sometimes not easy to accept criticism, no matter how accurate you realize it is. Does that kind of editing process and the criticism ever get in the way of...
Not really, no. I mean, I used to be... Joan would never sort of say anything directly to me, but I knew that if she didn't meet my eye, that she didn't like what she had read when she talked to me. When I was younger, I used to say something was junk, or that she missed the point, which I wouldn't say now, but now I wouldn't have to. I would say, I don't think this is working, and why don't you do X, Y, or Z? And that's never really been a problem.
You've collaborated together on screenplays. Are you writing any more screenplays?
Just finished one.
Of what?
It's an original or quasi-original screenplay for Disney, and it's about a young woman who gets out of college and goes to work in TV, and it's about the years when she's in local TV stations, and it ends with her getting the call to the network.
You once made the observation that you can never tell from a screenplay if a movie's going to be any good, because some of the best screenplays have been developed into some of the worst movies, and, and vice versa. Do you find that very frustrating when you write a screenplay?
No, it's one of the givens of making movies. I've said many times that that the best a screenwriter can hope to be in the process is a co-pilot. Those are just decisions over which you have no control.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll be writing a memoir again?
Never.
Why not?
I've done it, and the next time I won't be able to fool myself that I'm not doing it. The only reason I was able to continue on this one was that I was still thought of it as an introduction. I don't think I would ever do anything formal again.
Is there fallout from writing a memoir that you don't like? Or?
No.
Uh-huh. Uh-uh. Okay.
No. I just don't think that my life has been all that interesting, and it's just what you make of it.
John Gregory Dunn's book of autobiographical sketches is called Harp. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be actress Jamie Lee Curtis. She grew up in Hollywood, the daughter of Janet Leigh and Tony Curtis. Now she's in the TV sitcom Anything But Love and is starring in the new thriller Blue Steel. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a murder story about the murder of a person and the murder of the planet. Martin Amis tells us about his new end-of-the-millennium novel, London Fields. And there's two new TV specials about the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. TV critic David Bianculli reviews them both. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The Soviet Congress of People's Deputies is meeting in special session to debate whether to create a new-style Soviet presidency with wide executive powers. A vote was expected today, but the 2,000 deputies asked for more time. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
The Soviet Congress was expected to resolve these critical constitutional issues in a day. The chairman of the parliament's presidium tried to reassure the Congress the proposed law on the presidency would not lead to authoritarian rule, but instead greater democracy. It's generally agreed the idea is a good one, since an executive presidency would strengthen the government and diminish the role of the Communist Party apparatus. But opponents worried this particular law includes sweeping new powers that could threaten parliament's prerogatives and the republic's sovereignty. Radical deputies say they will accept the executive presidency only when there is a true multi-party state with constitutional checks and balances. Those in favor of the new law pointed to the deteriorating economy and the disintegration of the union as reasons to support it. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A breakup may be on the horizon for Israel's coalition government. The Labor Party gave its leaders authorization today to split from the government because of the Likud party's refusal to approve a U.S. peace proposal. The decision formalizes a threat to quit the government, but leaves time for a compromise to be worked out before 8 no-confidence votes scheduled for Thursday in Parliament. Nelson Mandela has started his first journey outside Africa, arriving in Sweden, where the official president of the African National Congress, Oliver Tambo, is recovering from a strike. Roger Wallace reports from Stockholm.
Exactly a month after his release from almost three decades in South African jails, Nelson Mandela arrived in Sweden. It's not surprising that Mr. Mandela, who's effectively running the ANC, should choose Sweden for this historic occasion. The ANC's official president, Oliver Tambo, who's spent a long period in exile, has been in a Swedish convalescent home for the last 6 months, recovering from a stroke. It's far from certain that Mr. Tambo will return to active politics. Nelson Mandela wants to meet him again after so many years of separation. Another reason for the Swedish visit is that neutral Sweden will be giving over $30 million of humanitarian aid this fiscal year to anti-apartheid organizations in South Africa. And almost half of that will go to Mr. Mandela's ANC. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Wallace in Stockholm.
Former Haitian military leader General Prosper Avril is in Florida 2 days after he was driven from power by widespread unrest. Avril and his family arrived at a Homestead Air Force base this morning. An Air Force spokesman says Avril was being driven to Boca Raton, after which he's on his own. Prices were slightly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 3.5 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. British writer Martin Amis is best known for his dark comic fiction about greed, sex, corruption, and the constant threat of nuclear annihilation. His books include The Rachel Papers, Money, Success, and Einstein's Monsters. Amis carries his pessimistic vision even further in his new novel, London Fields. As Michiko Kakutani put it in a New York Times review, it's a comic murder mystery, an apocalyptic satire, a scatological meditation on love and death and nuclear winter, Bonfire of the Vanities crossed with Gravity's Rainbow as narrated by Al Goldstein and Jonathan Swift. London Fields is set in London in 1999. Its novel within the novel is written by a dying American writer. His heroine is Nicola Six, a beautiful, suicidal woman who is actually plotting her own murder. But it's the end of the millennium, and global catastrophe is imminent. Nicola's main concern is that her private plan for self-destruction might be upstaged by the annihilation of the planet. I asked Martin Amis to read a short passage.
Was she nervous? Without question, it would be disagreeable at this late date to be upstaged by a Holocaust. If history, if current affairs, were to reach a climax on November the 5th during the full eclipse, then her own little drama, scheduled for the early minutes of the following day, would have no bite, no content, and absolutely no form. And no audience, no undivided attention. On the other hand, you wouldn't want to miss that either, the big event. I identify with the planet, thought Nicola with a nod as she started getting dressed. I know just how it feels. They say that everything wants to persist in its being. You know, even sand wants to go on being sand. I don't believe that. Some things want to live, and some things don't. As she clothed them, she consulted her breasts, which told her that the big event wouldn't happen, and that the little one would.
Do you think that the approach of the end of the millennium is bringing out a certain death wish in our culture?
I think it will. Death will be much in people's minds. This millennium differs from others in that, you know, whereas the jabbering 15th century or 9th century hermit could talk about the end of the world and say it was coming, every sensible man knew that the end of the world was staying right where it was. It just wasn't going to show up. But in this century and towards the end of this century, possible endings are there in two main forms, you know, the bang and the whimper, the bomb and the garbage sack. So the traditional disorientation and anxiety that comes with these big dates will have a real focus this time. It's not just a religious fantasy. It's actually on the shelves as a possibility.
But in addition to the fear of the end of the world or the fear of death, you bring out a certain yearning for it. I mean, hey, no responsibilities, no consequences to your actions. This will be the last time I have to wash the dishes.
Yeah. Well, she is presented as not typical, but I think she stands for that, you know, that huge trait in human beings, which is self-destructiveness. She's more of a distillation of that than most of us are. I think it was Emerson who said that, you know, by the time you get to the end of your life, you're ready to go. You know, no more of the boredoms, the little agonizing boredoms of life. What's happened in this century is that the planet Earth, which seemed an eternal creature, an eternal living thing, has suddenly aged 4.5 billion years in the space of half a century. So it's as if in middle age we're suddenly cracking up. And, you know, loss of beauty, the things that happen to you in middle age are terrifying and depressing and do fill your thoughts with death.
Your new novel, London Fields, comes after a collection of short stories called Einstein's Children that were all like nuclear-era short stories, and it had an introductory essay about our collective fear of nuclear weapons and what it's been like to grow up with nuclear weapons. How obsessive have you been about that in the past few years?
Well, I meant to relax now, I suppose, because... But what's always interested me most about nuclear weapons is their psychological effect on us. I don't know how old you are, but I've spent my childhood under a desk.
Yes, me too, yeah.
You know, metaphorically and literally. To have death for everybody as a realistic possibility, how does that trickle down into our morality? I think an awful lot of what's seen as, you know, really feral and wild and totally irresponsible about certain aspects of, you know, developed society has to do with this thing that the people at the top have on their, you know, option table, this death for everybody. So why not mug the granny, you know, because the government is going to mug everyone. I think it weakens the whole moral contract that keeps a society going.
Are your fears quieted with the ending of the Cold War?
Yeah, a bit. The weapons are still there, and the great bristling infrastructure of the nuclear wired-up planet is still there. It's a sort of trick nuclear weapons have of, you know, 1 year nuclear weapons are everything. People are out in the streets in their hundreds of thousands because of new deployments or tensions or whatever. And the next year, they're nothing. They disappear. They have this trick of pretending not to be there. At the moment, we're very, our awareness of nuclear weapons is very numb, dull. We don't think about them anymore. But one little twitch of geopolitics, and they could be right back there, slavering in their silos. And it's very easy to imagine a different kind of Soviet Union where the Ligachevites are back in, and an expansionist Soviet Union is the only one you could imagine after Gorbachev. So it's not over. And certainly the psychological scar tissue that we have in our heads hasn't been smoothed away.
As you said before, your book is about going out with a bang or a whimper, the bang being nuclear weapons, the whimper being pollution, deadly weather. Describe the kind of weather you've created for your end of the millennium novel.
Yeah, well, the weather I've created is already being outstripped by reality. I have the devil winds that seem to have already arrived in England. I have dead clouds, which are, if you could imagine a cloud dying and becoming this slippery fish-like thing that wanders around in the middle air. I have a new conjunction of moon, earth, and sun, which seems to place the sun lower on the horizon so that you come out of your house and it's right there at the end of the street, like a nuclear detonation, because that's what a nuclear detonation looks like, is the sun. And that's what the sun is a nuclear reactor. I also have a full eclipse, which sweeps across London on the climactic day of my plot and story. But I don't have what we might well get, which is hemispherical flooding and new kinds of lightning and whatever else is in store for us.
Martin Amis is my guest. His new end of the millennium novel is called London Fields. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Martin Amis is my guest. Your book, London Fields, is as much about language and writing as it is about anything else. There's a paragraph about writing that I'd like for you to read. It's on page 23.
Right. This is the narrator, the American Jewish blocked writer, or failed writer, who's transcribing this tale. I think it was Montalan who said that happiness writes white. It doesn't show up on the page. We all know this. The letter with a foreign postmark that tells of good weather, pleasant food, and comfortable accommodation isn't nearly as much fun to read or to write as the letter that tells of rotting chalets, dysentery, and drizzle. Who else but Tolstoy has made happiness really swing on the page? When I take on chapter 3, when I take on Guy Clinch, I'll have to do, well, not happiness, but goodness anyway. It's going to be rough.
Does this describe your feelings as a writer? That it's easier to write about despair than happiness, or easier to write about unlikable people than likable ones?
Well, I think we're all hooked on bad news, really. The two villainous characters in my novel, Keith Tallant the Cheat and Marmaduke, who's this rampaging infant, one-year-old baby, are, it seems to me, easily the most popular characters I've ever created. We like vigorous wrongdoing, I think. It doesn't mean you want to have Keith or Marmaduke over for the evening, but there's a great there's a great thrill in being able to read about wickedness or mischief when it's at arm's length.
You've been criticized by some people for misanthropy in your writing and misogyny. Is it just your pleasure in creating unlikable characters?
Well, you see, they're not.
People never know, I think, whether it's you or just your sense of what writes well that we're seeing.
Yes, it's that. I mean, you see me if you saw me in my civilian guise as the person who, you know, goes into shops and conducts his life, you would think me, you know, rather unusually polite and considerate and pleasant. But when I go into the study, some sort of demon takes over, and you know, I own up to feelings of Schadenfreude in my fiction. I delight in discomfort, mischief, wrongdoing. But it's as if it's another person doing all that. I do just find that comedy comes from the pointed end of things. From really sharp interactions between people. I'm not a very subtle writer. I like the grotesque, the extreme, above all.
It seems to me that you're working out of two really different impulses. One is this desire to fend off nuclear disaster, to spread the message that will help save the world. And the other is to make people uncomfortable, to write about wrongdoing, about mischief.
Well, I think that's just the traditional comic thing in rather an extreme form, in that... you know, Nabokov has this wonderful paragraph where he says, the way you punish the gangster in a work of fiction is not by having a tiptoeing assassin sneak up on him. It's by watching his horrible little finger probing around inside his ear as he makes some fatuous deal on the telephone. It's through contempt and laughter that you really pay them off, not through some trite punishment or conversion.
Do you rewrite a lot?
Yeah, I'm sort of a three-draft man. It's a longhand, then a type version of some kind, of crude type version, and then a final type version. But I don't, you know, I'm known as a stylist, as someone interested in language. But I would like to say that it's not that you take a normal perception and then boil it up with style. It's more that your perceptions come in that form, and then you have to make the whole fiction work out, and that's a lot of the rewriting comes from that. The phrases, you know, the points of style actually do, most of them appear in the first draft.
Now, your father is a well-known English writer, Kingsley Amis. When did you start writing?
I started writing when I wrote my first novel, when I was about 21. But I'd always, I think all writers, maybe all artists, get the call in adolescence. And I was about 14 when I decided that this was what I was going to do. And that was before, I mean, I knew my father was a writer, but I didn't know what kind of writer he was. I mean, for all I knew, he could have been writing westerns or supermarket romances. I didn't know he was a mainstream writer. I didn't know what the mainstream was. But I sort of felt that I was going to write about everyday life.
Did you read your father's books?
A little bit later, when I was about 17 or 18.
Did you like them?
I adored them, and still do. I like his stuff a lot more than he likes mine, but that's in a way how it should be. It would be a little creepy if he were mad about my stuff. I mean, you like the generation that came before. You don't like the generation that's snapping at your heels.
Oh, that's interesting. when you started writing, was your impulse to show your writing to your father or to hide it from him?
Well, he remembers. I don't remember this very clearly, but he remembers coming into my room. I was still living at home. I'd finished university, and I had a few months before I moved out. He came into my room, and I put my arm over the typewriter. As a sort of instinctive gesture. I didn't want him to see what I was writing. But I didn't show it to him until I went on holiday and left the galleys or the bound proof on his desk. So no one saw it until it was, in that form. So late on.
Did you look to your father for encouragement? For a sign of, like, do I have talent?
I don't think I was too anxious about it. Disgracefully cool to say. I think he was nice about the first novel. You know, not fulsome. The great thing is he never encouraged me. He never gave me a word of encouragement.
What's so great about that?
Well, I know quite a lot of writers who encourage their children to write, and it usually ruins the relationship. The thing is, writing talent isn't very strongly inherited. There aren't many cases of it. And I'm not talking about the son of a writer producing one book. I'm talking about him producing a body of work. There are practically no examples of it. So when the 16-year-old writer's son shows his daddy that poem he wrote or this short story he wrote, and the dad goes nuts about it and says, you're going to be a writer too, it's a very, very complicated emotional thing. It's like as if the dad is saying, you can have my life, you can be me. Now, what will happen in practically every case is that the son will not have enough talent, will not be a writer, and will then feel completely that he's been betrayed by his own father. And I know several cases of this, and I'm sure it was pure indolence on my father's part, by the way. I'm sure he didn't think it out, but he did do exactly the right thing, and I'm very grateful. And, you know, we have a very nice relationship, and it was never in danger.
Your book, London Fields, had already been published in England. It's now just been published in the States. Is there anything you think that Americans might not get?
Yeah, I think there's a certain patina about London lowlife that they won't get everything about any more than I get everything about an Elmore Leonard book, you know, or indeed a Sorbello book. There are things I won't know about. But I think that's not a disadvantage. I think a whiff of exoticism, even though it's, you know, sordid exoticism, sometimes strengthens the aura of a book. And, you know, I'm very pleased to find that Americans actually have less trouble with my books than some English reviewers and readers. That my humor speaks directly to Americans in a way that it doesn't to the English. So I'm usually surprised and gratified that they get me over here.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Martin Amis has been my guest. His new novel, London Fields, has just been published by Harmony Books. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. News from the Soviet Congress meeting in Moscow and news of the vote for an independent Lithuania. Also, NPR's Robert Siegel is back home from a couple of weeks traveling in the Soviet Union on assignment. He reports tonight on the gathering nationalist movement in the Soviet Republic of Georgia. Also, Cokie Roberts reports from the Texas primary election, and I'll be talking with Bela Fleck. Bela Fleck is quite a well-known banjo player living in Nashville. Bluegrass music and otherwise, he's been with the Newgrass Revival. He has a new jazz-oriented album entitled Bela Fleck and the Flecktones.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, Showtime presents a pair of one-hour specials commemorating the 20th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus. TV critic David Bianculli says even though the vintage clips are there, there's still something missing.
One of the crossbeams has gone out askew on the treadle.
What on earth does that mean?
I don't know. Mr. Wentworth just told me to come in here and say that there was trouble at the mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition.
Monty Python's Flying Circus premiered in England in 1969 and on American public TV stations in 1974. So a pair of 20th anniversary specials in 1990 seems like vintage Python's silliness. But it isn't. These two programs, one a series of interviews, the other a package of highlights, were shown in England last year on the actual anniversary and are only now being imported by Showtime. The time delay explains the otherwise startling appearance by Graham Chapman, who died of cancer last November. Nothing explains, though, why these specials didn't make more of the opportunity. The first special, Life of Python, starts out fine. It shows how the six members of the group got together, using clips from British TV shows on which various Python members wrote or performed. We learn the inspiration for the silly Monty Python name and for some of Terry Gilliam's outrageous illustrations. Then the Pythons set out explaining what made the show funny, or at least what made them laugh. Here's John Cleese.
We just used to hoot with delight when we suddenly thought of some other silly thing we could do, like run the titles halfway through the show, have everybody leave the room and then think, wait a minute, you know, and then pretend to go on as though it's BBC News picking up something.
One thing I don't like about this show is that the Pythons are interviewed individually, so there's no interaction. It's obvious, even 20 years later, that Terry Jones still dislikes John Cleese a little, and that some of the others feel guilty that they kept the show going a while after Cleese quit. Another thing I don't like is that there's no mention of what the Python members have done since breaking up. That's some of the best stuff. John Cleese did Fawlty Towers. Cleese and Michael Palin did A Fish Called Wanda. Palin and Terry Jones did Ripping Yarns. Eric Idle did The Ruddles. And Terry Gilliam did Brazil. The highlight special, 20 Years of Monty Python, Parrot Sketch Not Included, does a better job of putting Monty Python's Flying Circus in the context of the times. It ridiculed authority years before Saturday Night Live came along, and that defiance was intentional and direct. When a sketch made fun of a particular group, it sometimes ended with a joke about the very response it was likely to provoke.
He's up and he's okay. He sits all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump. I like to press wildflowers. I put on women's clothing and hang around in bars.
Dear sir, I wish to complain in the strongest possible terms about the song which you have just broadcast about the lumberjack who wears women's clothes. Many of my best friends are lumberjacks, and only a few of them are transvestites.
Both of these Python specials just stop rather than end. But come to think of it, half the Monty Python sketches did the same thing. They either rely on Gilliam's animation, or when they got really stuck for an ending, just play the theme music and get the hell out of there. Good idea.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with actress Jamie Lee Curtis. Also, we meet Czech emigre writer Joseph Skvoretsky. Since the early 70s, his Canadian publishing house has specialized in works banned in Czechoslovakia by authors who, until recently, wrote in defiance of the state. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Join us tomorrow and call in with your questions and comments. That's Radio Times between 3 and 4 here on 91 FM in Philadelphia.
And the time is 8 o'clock on 91 FM. Good evening. My name is Melinda Whiting, and Dan Lachlan is our engineer for Evening Classics tonight. We're with you until 11 o'clock. On the program tonight, Harold in Italy by Berlioz coming up a little later. Also a Beethoven sonata for violin and piano. And we'll celebrate the birthday of the legendary tenor Tito Skipa.